reading today is from James Baldwin's essay, My Dungeon Shook. Baldwin wrote this essay as a letter to his nephew on the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation. This is the crime of which I accuse my country and my countrymen, for which neither I, nor time, nor history will ever forgive them. That they have destroyed and are destroying hundreds of thousands of lives and do not know it and do not want to know it. It is their innocence that constitutes this crime. This innocent country set you down in a ghetto in which, in fact, it intended that you should perish. The limits of your ambition were thus expected to be set forever. You were born into a society which spelled out with brutal clarity, in as many ways as possible, that you were a worthless human being. You were not expected to aspire to excellence. You were expected to make peace with mediocrity. You have, and many of us have, defeated this intention, and by terrible law, a terrible paradox, those innocents who believed that your imprisonment made them safe are losing their grasp on reality. But these men are your brothers, your lost younger brothers. And if the word integration means anything, this is what it means, that we, with love, shall force our brothers to see themselves as they are, to cease fleeing reality and to begin to change it. For this is your home, my friend. Do not be driven from it. Great men have done great things here and will again. And we can make America what it must become. It will be hard. But you come from sturdy peasant stock. Men who picked cotton and dammed rivers, built railroads, and in the teeth of the most terrifying odds, achieved an unassailable and monumental dignity. You come from a long line of great poets since Homer. One of them said, "The very time I thought I was lost, my dungeon shook and my chains fell off." We cannot be free until they are free. God bless you, and Godspeed.
In 1980, 350,000 Americans were incarcerated. Today, 2,300,000 Americans are incarcerated. 350,000 to 2,300,000 in 30 years. Additionally, 4 million Americans today are on probation, and nearly a million are paroled. Most of this dramatic increase over these 30 years is a direct result of the war on drugs declared by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. His successors, both Democratic and Republican, have carried on the drug war. The result has been a cascade of arrests and convictions for possessing and trafficking in drugs and an explosion in our prison population. An amazing amount of money has been spent by federal, state, and local governments to finance increased better armed law enforcement and the massive buildup of our prison system. Some have aptly called this the prison industrial complex. If you look at the numbers, they suggest a huge connection to race in this explosion of incarceration. The incarceration rate for African Americans nationwide is 6 times that of white Americans. 1 in 14 black men today is behind bars, compared to 1 in 106 white men. Something like half the prison population in our country is African American, even though African Americans represent about 14% of the American population. The figures really are nothing short of astonishing. A higher percentage of our black population is incarcerated today than was the case in South Africa at the height of apartheid. More African Americans today are under the control of the criminal justice system than were enslaved in 1850. The numbers are even more astonishing in Wisconsin, where the ratio of blacks to whites incarcerated is higher than the national average. As with the overall prison population, the bulk of African Americans who are imprisoned are there for drug-related offenses. In many states, 90% of drug offenders in the prison system are black or Hispanic. Even though African Americans are estimated to account for about 13% of the drug use in this country, so that's about what you'd expect given the population, African Americans serve nearly 3/4 of the prison time served for simple possession of drugs. These statistics are all the more astonishing given the fact that the percent of folks who engage in not only drug possession and use, but also trafficking are similar across all ethnicities. So the impact on African Americans of this inordinately high incarceration rate goes way beyond the people serving time. There's a huge impact on families of incarcerated African Americans, the families they leave behind. And the impact stretches far beyond the end of the incarceration. Parole and probation, those keep millions under the control of the criminal justice system. So, for example, convicted felons serving time do not have the right to vote in the vast majority of states. And many states do not allow convicted felons to vote after their release for years up to life. So because of the disproportionate number of convicted African American felons, this ends up having a significant impact on African Americans' entitlement to vote. Over 2 million African Americans are not allowed to vote today, some 8% of the African American voting age population. More African Americans are disenfranchised today than was the case in 1870. In Wisconsin, more than 11% of the African American population has lost the right to vote. In Florida, some 600,000 convicted felons did not have the right to vote in the 2000 presidential election. It's not a stretch to think that election might have had a different result had some of these felons, including many of them who had supposedly paid their debt to society, had the right to vote. There's another aspect to disenfranchisement in states, many states, including Wisconsin. Inmates here and in many states are counted in the population where they are imprisoned, not in the place they lived prior to incarceration into which they most likely will return. But of course they're not able to vote. So because so many prisoners in Wisconsin are African Americans from Milwaukee, this means Milwaukee has relatively less electoral clout, while places that have large prison complexes, mostly white, more rural locations in Wisconsin, have relatively more clout. Also in the federal justice system and in most states, convicted felons are banned from serving on juries for the rest of their lives. So again, this has a disproportionate impact on the African American community. Some 30% of African Americans in our country, males, are not allowed ever to serve on juries. So this can racially skew the jury profiles. And the loss of voting rights and the right to serve on juries, this is only the tip of the iceberg of the legalized discrimination and stigma experienced by felons after their release from incarceration. Checking the felony box on a job application makes it difficult to get an interview, let alone get a job. Not checking the box and having a felony show up in the criminal background check is probably even worse. So once again, the impact of this is disproportionately large on the African American community. Ex-felons also in our country face legalized housing discrimination. For example, it's perfectly legal to deny public housing to an ex-felon or even someone who's been arrested but not necessarily convicted. Once again, the burden falls disproportionately on African Americans. So we have a system that results in disproportionate disenfranchisement and legally sanctioned discrimination against a whole lot of African Americans in this country. Michelle Alexander wrote a very compelling book about this issue. She was a lawyer for the ACLU. Copies of the book are available in our bookstore. And she opens the book by writing about a black man named Javius Cotton. He cannot vote today because he's on parole. His father couldn't vote during Jim Crow segregation because he couldn't pay the poll tax or pass the literacy test. The KKK prevented his grandfather from voting through intimidation. The KKK murdered his great-grandfather, beating him to death when he attempted to vote. And his great-great-grandfather couldn't vote because he was a slave. So the question, does our contemporary criminal justice system echo Jim Crow segregation and even slavery before that? My answer is yes. Given the racial skew of who is getting thrown into prison and then disenfranchised and then discriminated against after prison, I believe that this new prison industrial complex is a manifestation of systemic racism. So what in the last 30 years has happened to create this mammoth prison industrial complex in its racist underbelly? Well, the roots go back to the Republican Party's Southern strategy, dreamt up by Richard Nixon. If you look at the middle of the last century, with brief exceptions, the coalition that supported the Democratic Party dominated electoral politics. The Southern strategy was an effort by Republicans to peel off the white working class layer of that coalition, particularly in the South. And the most effective way to do that was to stoke a feeling of resentment among working class whites against African Americans. President Nixon's Lieutenant H.R. Haldeman, a name that we may remember from Watergate, put the strategy succinctly. He said that Nixon emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. Another Nixon lieutenant, John Ehrlichman, put Nixon's election strategy more bluntly, "We'll go after the racists," he said. Ehrlichman observed that the subliminal appeal of the anti-black voter was always present in Nixon's statements and speeches. Ronald Reagan perfected the strategy. In 1980, after receiving the presidential nomination, his first speech was at the Neshoba County Fair in Mississippi. Neshoba County is where three civil rights workers were famously murdered in 1964. Reagan chose not to talk about those murders in his speech. Instead, he talked about states' rights. States' rights, the rallying cry of the Confederacy. I believe this was a coded appeal to anti-black voters following the Nixon blueprint. I want to note that in 2005, the Republican Party National Committee Chairman apologized to the nation for the Southern strategy. And yet, it seems to continue to be used. The fact an African American occupies the White House today may have something to do with that. In recent weeks, Newt Gingrich has called President Obama the food stamp president. He has asserted that blacks need to demand jobs, not food stamps. And he has said that poor children lack a work ethic and that perhaps we should put them to work cleaning our public schools. So what's the connection of the Southern strategy to the prison industrial complex? Well, it turns out that the war on drugs has been an exceptionally effective vehicle for advancing the Southern strategy. So the Reagan administration declared the war on drugs in 1982. They put the focus on the war on punishment and deterrence rather than trying to reduce demand. So law enforcement budgets dramatically increased. At the same time, government support for drug treatment, education, and prevention went down. Law enforcement agencies had a huge incentive to jump on board. Federal funding would increase as they increased their drug deterrence focus. In 1 year alone, in Jackson County, Wisconsin, late in the 1990s, when Bill Clinton was president, Jackson County quadrupled its drug arrests. The same year, then, its federal subsidy for law enforcement quadrupled, too. The federal largesse, among other things, created and enabled the police to weaponize, militarize its weaponry. At the same time, Supreme Court rulings made it easier to round up Americans and granted extraordinary license to police about who they pulled over. Legislatively mandated longer and harsher sentences, mandatory minimums, for example, exploded the prison population with drug offenders, most of whom were nonviolent. So the Reagan administration needed a focus for this war on drugs to stoke the public's commitment to it. The year it was declared, 2% of the American population said this was a serious problem. Well, a focus on blacks would prove effective for this and at the same time help this Southern strategy. So the administration quickly zeroed in on the perfect focus, inner city drug use, and especially in the 80s, the explosion of crack cocaine in the inner cities. Now, the war on drugs could have just as logically been focused on college campuses or suburbs. Either of these focuses, of course, would have put the aim more on whites, and our prisons today would look very different. Classism and racism, I believed, converged on the choice of target for the war on drugs. So with an inner city focus, African Americans who, remember, use and sell drugs at about the same rate as whites, they became the focal point of the war on drugs. And the poster child became the young black man. A survey of Americans in 1995 invited people to picture in their minds a drug user. 95% of Americans who took the survey pictured a young African American man. George Bush, the elder, won election in 1988 partly on the basis of that infamous Willie Horton ad, which stoked on this new public fear of African-American males. Bill Clinton vowed never to allow the Republicans to be perceived as tougher on crime than he was. So he escalated the war of drugs to new, unheard-of levels, and the whole prison industrial complex grew even more under Clinton. A dozen years after Clinton left office, today the war on drugs and the burgeoning prison industrial complex seem to be permanent, unquestioned features of American life. And the prison industrial complex today no longer needs the Southern strategy to survive and thrive. You see, part of the genius of the Southern strategy, coupling it with the war on drugs, is that racism, the racism underlying this incredible disparity of who the war targeted, that got obscured. The focus instead is on the people who are incarcerated or still in the control of the criminal justice system. They're mostly guilty of violating drug laws. In this sense, they're not innocent people. We have a society based on laws. They broke the laws. They're paying the price. It's about violating the laws, it seems, not about the color of skin. So the underlying racism of this has been cloaked in this colorblindness. What we don't think about is that African Americans are guilty of violating drug laws probably at about the same rate as whites, only whites are much less likely to be prosecuted or arrested. Sure, some are. And we might consider the whites who get caught in the drug war collateral damage. But if you use or sell drugs and you're white, you are much less likely to find yourself in the grips of our criminal justice system. I have a hunch, and I have to tell you this is partly based on personal experience, that there are plenty of white folks in this room today who theoretically could have been arrested for drug use in our teens or 20s. But because the drug war was focused on inner cities and not college campuses, not suburbs, not small, whiter cities like Appleton, we weren't arrested. Now, I don't want to suggest that this massive incarceration of African Americans is exactly like Jim Crow, but the net result of the mass incarceration is familiar. Legalized discrimination, stigma, exclusion. These characteristics have survived from slavery to Jim Crow, now to this mass incarceration. As the Unitarian Universalist minister Bill Jones asserts, racism has disguised itself, mutating and reclaiming lost territory through ingenious disguises and conceptual camouflages. So it's not about blacks, it's about criminals. Well, if you're Javius Cotton, and you can't vote, and you can't serve on juries, and maybe you can't find a decent job all because you committed a felony, well, I'm not sure life feels all that different from what it might have been like for your father or your grandfather or great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather. Well, if you are persuaded by this analysis, and I don't presume you all are, but if you are, then the question might be, okay, now what? What do I do? What can I do to change this? I have some ideas, but first I want to say that this may not be your issue, even if you are persuaded by what I just said, and that's okay. Pick an issue to work on. This might be it. Maybe it's not. Just work on something. But if this is your issue, if this cries out to your soul and you want to do something, I've got some ideas about how to do it. The first thing is to engage with the issue. I've given you a lot of numbers today in the hopes that you'll engage with these numbers. It's easy to put this whole issue out of our minds, especially when we see so many images in the media of the black criminal that we start to think black and criminal go together. But the numbers suggest it's not just about those who break the law, but those who are targeted for prosecution. The first step is stripping away the camouflage and taking a deeper look at this. Then, second step I suggest is that you seriously consider getting out of the car that safely ensconces most of us from this world that is distant, the world of inner cities and drug raids and vast members of a community serving time in prison. Part of the answer, Michelle Alexander suggests, is embracing and advocating for rather than condemning a stigmatized group of people. Part of the success of the prison industrial complex has been really the understandable reluctance of civil rights advocates to advocate for criminals. This is not a population where we are likely to find a virtuous symbol of injustice like Rosa Parks. So I want to lift up the number of people in our fellowship, some of whom are here today, who have gotten out of that car and gone to work either professionally or as volunteers in our criminal justice system, working with prisoners or working with ex-prisoners. I haven't done this work, but I can guess it's not easy work. But it's a way to engage with the issue, to learn about, and maybe help a few human beings caught in the system. This can make a difference for some folks, and that matters. And then there is also clearly a huge role in this for advocacy. Mass incarceration of African Americans is based on a web of laws and policies. We need to work on undoing these strands. And there's a lot of strands to undo. I'd suggest a few. Let's end the war on drugs. Let's vastly reduce the prison population. Let's give people who have served time, paid their debt, full rights as citizens. Just a few. not going to be easy. Slavery took the Civil War to end. Jim Crow took this amazing mass movement, plus the legislative and the judiciary, to end. This is going to need a mass movement probably too. Where to start? Start pulling at some of these strands. Wisdom, the statewide network of interfaith social justice organizations, of which Esther is the local chapter, Wisdom has recently announced a campaign called 11 by 15. The goal of this campaign is to reduce the prison population in Wisconsin from 35,000 down to 11,000 by 2015. That is an audacious goal, reducing our prison population by more than two-thirds. To put it in line with Minnesota, our neighboring state that has similar demographics, a similar crime rate, and half the people in prison that we have. Wisdom advocates for all sorts of cheaper, more effective alternatives to incarceration. The impact of accomplishing this goal would be immense, especially for African Americans who have been inordinately targeted in this war on drugs. So engaging in 11 by 15 is a great place to start. Ending this new Jim Crow, again, will not be easy. Nothing I've suggested in the sermon series is easy. Not individually moving from unconscious incompetence to competence when you interact with people of different ethnicities. Not moving our fellowship or our faith beyond being a white ethnic religion. Not building a society in which differences are valued and the underlying unity of all is treasured. None of these things is easy. But every step forward toward a more fair, just, inclusive world, that's what we need to do. If we can move toward such a world, even a little bit, it's worth the effort, it's worth the risk, it's worth the frustration, it's worth the heartache. This is the work we need to do, and we can, I hope, together imagine a much better world.